I'm Shane Clark from UMass Amherst, and this is some work with a number of collaborators, including Ben and Amir, who are here today, and Kevin, who you saw earlier today, doing his chairing duties, and who, of course, came up with the punny system name. But this is a project about getting greater visibility into malware infections on medical devices. Now, instead of motivating the problem first, I want to present sort of a high level of where I'm going with this, so the system that I'm going to be talking about today, so that we're all on the same page. This is a medical device. In this case, it's a pharmaceutical compounder. And it happens to run Windows, which is unfortunate for a number of reasons, but the reality for a lot of devices these days. In the panel this morning, Lynette talked a fair amount about COTS systems, and so did Ken. But this medical device plugs into an outlet, and we would like to use this outlet as a source of information about what's happening on the medical device. So we'd like to capture data from it, power traces, and analyze those power traces for evidence of suspicious activity. And if we see anything happening that we don't expect in the power trace, we can issue a warning like, hey, you might have a virus on your medical device. And we've talked a lot about why this is hard with other systems, and I'll get more into that later. But now I'll step back and actually motivate the problem in our sort of design space a little bit more carefully. This is a MAUD report. So MAUD is the FDA post-market surveillance system, or an FDA post-market surveillance system, in which healthcare providers report adverse events. And this is a MAUD report for a Baxa EM2400 compounder, which is what I showed you a picture of on the last slide. And the adverse event in this case is that the compounder has a virus on it. And the healthcare provider doesn't know what impact that will have on the device. So we've got a virus infecting it, but there's a tension now because you don't know if it's actually going to be a problem in terms of availability or safety. And you have to balance this tension where you want to provide patient care and be available, but you definitely don't want to put them at risk by using a malfunctioning device. So it's a tough spot. And of course, this isn't the only instance of that. This is an excerpt from a Wall Street Journal article where they were talking about how the VA had to shut down a catheterization clinic because the VLAN with all of the devices on it had become infected, and so they couldn't perform what sounds to me like bypass surgery, but they didn't describe it as such, so I don't know what the actual procedure was. So the first part of the problem is that malware infects medical devices, and we can agree on that as a problem, I think. Another quote from Lynette this morning was, less than 1% of our devices are network connected. And that hints at a second piece of this problem, which is that a lot of the solutions in the consumer space do not readily apply. You can't just install a firewall or a networked intrusion detection system and expect to catch things because you might not have any visibility into a large portion of your device population. And we heard about problems with antivirus as well because you're changing software and all of a sudden there are regression testing and certification concerns. Now the third piece of this problem is that we have a real lack of reporting. This is the conclusion from a paper that appeared in PLOS One last year, in which they looked at a number of post-market surveillance systems, including MAUD and a data set from the FDA, from VA, rather, and also a third source, and concluded that no effective system even exists to detect signals of security or privacy problems. So there's just a total lack of reporting for that specific class of issue. And once again, from Lynette this morning, I was taking lots of notes during the panel. The question she asked was, are we looking for it, right? Like, even if these infections are widespread, how would we know if we don't know whether people are doing traffic analysis or they're actually logging things in a meaningful way and they're not reporting it? So that sort of fills out my description of the problem, which is that we have malware on medical devices. There are existing solutions out there, but they don't really apply very nicely in a lot of cases. And we don't know the extent of the problem. We don't understand how prevalent this is and how we should deal with it in the general case. So after looking at the problem, I've come up with my own set of requirements for any solution. And I'll claim, without justification, that these are the requirements for an ideal solution. So we should not require any software changes on the device because of concerns about regressions, certification, manufacturer interactions, et cetera. There are a lot of reasons to avoid that. We don't want to require updates, because if you need updates, that means that you need to expose something to the internet at the end of the day. Even if you do it with a USB key, that was plugged into an internet-connected device, so you're increasing your attack surface. We want to avoid manual configuration. So talked a lot about VLANs and access control lists and how they're manual and painful and have high ongoing costs. And that's a major issue. And finally, I'm going to claim that you shouldn't require a network connection because we know that a lot of these devices don't actually have network interfaces and are not designed to be regularly connected to a network. So looking at the systems that are out there today, none of them meet all the requirements. Mine does, of course. I'll explain a little bit more why I think that's true. So the basic approach, which I showed as sort of a physical interpretation before, is this. We've got this embedded medical system, and it's in a validated state, right? It's been cleared or approved, which are different things I learned, and it's in a state that we believe to be good. And it's now exposed to sources of malware that we'd like to protect it from. So rather than sort of piercing this validated bubble or trying to play whack-a-mole on all of the attack vectors, we're going to monitor the power line, which is the only convenient observation point left in this diagram, and identify what's happening. For those who are less familiar with it, because I know this is a pretty interdisciplinary venue, power analysis, quickly, is just the process of making inferences based on traces of power consumption over time. So you have a series of time and voltage or current pairs, and based on those changes, you want to come to some conclusion about what's happening on the device you're monitoring. The intuition behind why this should work for medical devices is that embedded medical devices have specific limited tasks. So even ones that are built using commercial off-the-shelf software and hardware are not supposed to be browsing the internet with Internet Explorer or running Word. They're supposed to be delivering some sort of care to a patient in a constrained way. And if we can identify these specific tasks, then we should be able to identify later deviations from those tasks. For this work, we tested two devices. One of them, which I've already shown you twice, was the Baxa Xactimix compounder. And I'll describe that a little bit more carefully in a minute. And we also tested a Schweitzer substation computer, which is actually an industrial control system. We've pointed out a lot of similarities between medical devices and control systems in the panel this morning, too. But we got one because it's really rather difficult to get your hands on a functioning medical device in a lot of cases if you're not affiliated with a hospital. And so we thought this was a really good approximation of a medical device. If you look at the configurations here, they both run variants of Windows XP Embedded, and they're both these x86 commodity platforms that have just had hardware and software grafted onto them to make them into some special high-assurance device. But they're built on the same platform a consumer might buy. So the compounder, which is what I'll focus on for most of the talk, does a few things. It's, as I understand it, used to mix solutions for patients who can't feed themselves. So you can use it for feeding tubes or for IVs where you have to mix something custom. And you provide medications or chemicals at inputs, which hang just above the frame here in the picture. And it has a pump, and it mixes them according to a recipe and then verifies the output by weighing the solution it produces. So it knows the density of all these things that it's trying to mix, and it can verify that it's done the right thing. It also flushes its inputs, which is an important thing, because you don't want to cross-contaminate medications in a clinical environment. And it spends a lot of time sitting around idle. I listed that as something that the compounder does because If we assume that it's either doing these unique operations where it's running a pump or running a digital scale or flushing inputs, or it's just sitting there idle, then we have a relatively constrained state space where we can say we expect it to be doing not much of anything or these specific tasks. Now, coming back to trace collection a little bit more carefully, this is what our system actually looks like in terms of collecting data. We have a medical device which we plug into a special instrumented outlet we built. It just has a current sense resistor built in behind the outlet, and that allows us to gather a power trace by sampling it with a data acquisition unit. We then store it on a separate computer for offline analysis. For both of these devices, we gathered traces of normal and abnormal conditions to test whether we can separate them. In the case of the compounder, normal included sitting idle, mixing chemicals, rebooting, being started and logging in, things like that. The abnormal behavior included emulated and real malware. So we did write some emulated malware, including a keylogger, a screen grabber, and another one that tried to connect to a server every X seconds, as just examples of common malware tasks. And then we went looking for popular malware that we downloaded actual samples of and manually infected the compounder and the substation computer as well with. So each time we would install the malware, gather traces, and then wipe the system and repeat to get these traces. We got a total of about 2,500 5-second traces for each device to use for our training and testing purposes. Before I show you an example of what some of the traces look like, I just want to describe what an AC power trace in general looks like for those who may not know. So that they're sinusoidal. It's a 60 hertz carrier carrying power. And changes in power consumption create changes in amplitude if you look at a trace. These are traces from our compounder. These are just raw power traces. And the sampling rate and the time span is such that you can't see the sinusoid. But in the idle trace on the top, you can see that the amplitude is essentially the same the whole time. Nothing much is happening. In the infected trace in the bottom, where it's got an actual virus on it, you see these unexpected spikes in amplitude. So this seems to confirm our intuition that having some sort of extra workload on there will produce odd power consumption patterns when we would expect the device to be idle. And knowing that qualitatively is really good, but we'd like to be able to do this quantitatively and automatically. So the next step is to build a real classifier for it. We used standard machine learning techniques for this. So we chose a number of classifiers, which are discussed in more detail in the paper, and we gathered traces to train and test them on. Each time you gather a trace, you extract a feature vector, which is just a compact characterization of a power trace. So in our case, for each 5-second power trace, we extracted 18 features. And these are things like the skewness or the variance, excuse me, or the root mean square of the power trace that describe how the values are changing over time in the trace. And the classifier actually operates on those. For experimental setup, we partitioned everything into equal training and testing sets, both equally delicious, and trained our system using stratified tenfold cross-validation. And I won't get too into stratified tenfold cross-validation, but it's a standard way of avoiding biases in the training and testing sets, where if you just take a totally random split, you might end up with something where your two sets are not representative of one another. This just seeks to make them even. Putting all this together, this is what the training and testing process looks like. Above the dashed line is training time, when for each state that we want to profile, we gather a set of traces, we perform feature extraction, and we supply a label. After doing that, we feed it to the system, which is supposed to learn this feature vector maps to this state, either clean or infected. At testing time, below the dashed line, the only real difference is we don't provide a label. We ask the system to use its own internal model it's built to output a label for us. And just one more thing I have to talk about before I get to the actual results. And that's metrics quickly. Accuracy is the easiest metric for stuff like this, but we also present some other metrics because accuracy has the potential to be misleading in this case. If you have very biased data sets, for example, like this, you could achieve very high accuracy by marking everything as infected because the clean traces, which you have missed all of, comprise a small piece of the data set. And our traces are actually pretty biased toward infected traces because they were quicker to gather repeatedly in an automated fashion. So to avoid that being a big problem, we also present precision and recall. These are standard information retrieval metrics. You can think of precision as the resistance to false positives. So if you have 100% precision, it means that you never identified a clean trace as an infected one. Recall is resistance to false negatives. So if you have 100% recall, it means that you identified every infected trace as an actual infected trace. None of them got by. Finally, here are the results for the two devices that we tested. For the compounder, we had 94% accuracy overall, 94% precision, and 76% recall, which tells us that we did a very good job of not having false positives in a lot of cases, though some malware slipped by. So we caught a little over 3/4 of all of the infected traces in this experiment. For the substation computer, the story's a little different. We had many, many traces, and so the accuracy is almost perfect. The precision recall both round to 100%. Now, in this scenario, we trained and tested on all of the states. So every piece of malware appeared in the training set and in the testing set. And that's also true for all of the normal operations. But if you were paying careful attention to the table I showed you before, then this might bother you because I claimed that our system requires no updates. And the only way to achieve that state over time is if you actually profile every piece of malware. And that puts you back in the antivirus scenario where you have definitions per piece of badness. And we don't want that because then you just have another system to maintain and keep up to date and exposed to the internet. So what we'd like to be able to do is learn a generic signature for things that are not okay, right? So we'd like to know these are the power traces that we accept and all else we reject. To that end, we ran a second set of experiments to test the performance in detecting unknown malware. So these are some of the actual pieces of malware that we used. And what we did is we partitioned them into disjoint training and testing sets. So anything that appeared at training time did not appear at testing time and vice versa. My favorite piece of malware, Dorkbot, for example, would only be in the testing set. And the only way to identify that accurately is if the classifier can separate all of this anomalous activity from what we've taught it is good activity. So rerunning the analysis, these are the new results. The accuracy for the compounder data set went down by about 5%. And the accuracy for the substation computer data set went down by about 15%. And I know it's difficult to have a sense of whether these numbers are any good in isolation. So the closest point of comparison we found was a recent paper on behavior-based antivirus that uses a traditional software approach. So this is a paper that appeared at IEEE Security and Privacy a few years ago. And our accuracy is actually very similar to their accuracy, even though they were using an installed piece of software that was looking at what was happening on the system at a different level of granularity, though they do have the important advantage of having 100% precision. I'd be remiss not to point that out. So the next steps for our system are to develop more easily deployable hardware and to get a lot more field testing done, because we think that the results on the devices we've looked at are promising, but it's really a pretty limited set of devices we've been able to evaluate. And we'd love to get more data from realistic clinical environments. And we're making an effort right now to engage manufacturers and care providers in helping us to field test some of this stuff. So if there are any of you in the audience who could help us with that, that'd be great. This is a picture of one of our early prototypes. I promise the most recent ones look less like fire risks, and in fact are not fire risks. and before I wrap up, I do need to acknowledge that there's a lot of related work in various aspects of this work. So there's a long history of non-intrusive load monitoring going back to the 80s, which is this sort of appliance-level power monitoring. Lots of attack papers using differential power analysis. And there's even some very closely related work in which they were trying to do malware detection on smartphones using power analysis, though the scenario is a little bit different because they're battery-powered devices running on phone operating systems. So to wrap things up, WhatsUp Doc can detect evidence of malware infection, and it doesn't require any hardware or software changes to the device you're trying to protect. And in our experiments, we achieved a mean about 86% accuracy, which is similar to software behavior-based malware detectors. And with that, I'm happy to take questions.
So I find this fascinating. My question is, what guarantee do you have from malware developers that they are unable to make the malware stealth from the point of view of this kind of detection mechanism? Mm-hmm.
So that's a good question, and it's something that that has come up before in questions.
Uh-huh. Sure,
and
sure.
So The goal here is to, at this point at least, to protect devices that are primarily protect devices that are sort of collateral damage and are getting infected with generic malware. And in that case, I don't think it's worth the malware developer's time to try to circumvent this specific technique. In the case of you know, your own laptop or notebook computer, right, you're going to be doing many, many more things, and I think that our technique is not likely to apply as well because we don't have a simple training scenario where we can profile everything you might do. So I don't think you'd see this kind of technique deployed widespread enough to justify their time investment. I guess that's my answer. Right? I think that they'll stick to low-hanging fruit.
So you're assuming that the malware they are producing is generic, so they are not targeting specifically those kind of devices.
Yeah, that's the assumption, in this piece of work, yes.
Thank you.
I should have been more clear about that. But, yeah.
I'm Ann Cox from DHS. Have you looked at a home setting for medical devices or only an institutional setting? For example, many people use a CPAP, a continuous positive air pressure device, at night while they sleep, and there's a huge base of those. They are networked in as much as they have a card in them that can be read and can be accessed over the network.
We haven't looked at devices like that, but that's a really great idea, actually, because I'd imagine it's somewhat easier to get our hands on a CPAP machine as well.
Yeah, they run anywhere from, I don't know, $400 to $1,000 or so.
That's cheap in the scheme of things.
Yes, yeah. It is, but you also have quite a large user base, not only in your older population, but I actually have a couple of grandchildren, like ages 10 and 14, that use them. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I get excited. Marcel Simon from J&J. So having detected malware, mm-hmm. So we're talking about devices that are not networked by and large, so there is really no ability to get rid of the malware. So what do you do with it?
Yeah, so this doesn't answer the mitigation question. Mm-hmm. That's certainly true. This is about detection and understanding which devices are vulnerable and which devices are being compromised. So the follow-up would be much like it is today, where I think in a lot of cases the policy in a hospital is to just wipe the machine, to re-image it. But you would at least have greater visibility into what's happening so that you know which devices need that.
This is Jean Stanford from Novelis. I just wanted to know, do you think this will scale? So if the hospital has 15 of these devices, will they all have the same characteristic signature, or we have to reanalyze each individual one?
Yeah, that's a good question, too. I believe it will scale because, in theory, they're the same hardware and software configuration, but we don't have multiple copies of the same device to verify that empirically. At least not right now.
I have a question, actually.
Okay.
If I plug this in, my name is Darren Lacey. I'm from Johns Hopkins. If I plug this in, if I put it on one of my medical devices, am I out of spec? I mean, basically, have I just essentially voided the warranty and done all kinds of things if the device doesn't work?
I would, so the best I can tell, probably not. I spoke off the record, of course, because he's not supposed to do this, to someone who works at Underwriters Laboratory, right? So UL certifies many, many electrical devices, and his best guess at how something like this would be classified is not as a medical device. So depending on the specification you targeted in building the actual hardware, if you were selling it, you'd probably not run afoul of FDA.
And an unrelated question. I mean, one of the things we use all the time and for intrusion detection is NetFlow. I mean, NetFlow is one of our big, and this obviously has to do with network devices. So I was wondering if you, with network devices, if you thought about either comparing it to NetFlow, because we look for anomalous, and we don't just look for whether NetFlowing to malicious sites or there's something. We actually look for just anomalies in NetFlow, both for performance issues and also for security. And I was wondering if you actually would do this, either comparing it to NetFlow analysis or actually matching it up with NetFlow analysis to get greater levels of precision.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely the opportunity for it to be complementary to existing approaches, right? It's not the sort of thing that would taint any data that you would get from another source. So where things like NetFlow apply, you could certainly use them both and try to correlate them. In the particular case of the device that we had, it wasn't part of a larger clinical network, so it wasn't exactly clear how we could reasonably compare it to something like NetFlow because we didn't have a great picture of what the traffic should look like, or if there should be any.
Yeah, hi, Dennis Schneider from Baxter Healthcare. One of the reasons to use the network operating systems like Wind Rivers or Windows Embedded are becoming more popular is that the complexity of joining a large network has really gotten quite significant. Doing it yourself has gotten inappropriate. Now, what that also means is that updates come along with the party. Mm-hmm. And it would seem to me that continuing to try to generate, as you know, I don't know how many gazillion updates come out for the average operating system each year as we're going along, but that's going to change the patterning, I would assume, just the basic operations of the system. So what effect is the, you know, like in the past, you know, when you issued a pump and it had software in it, or you did a compounder, it didn't change for years. Mm-hmm. We just purge the field of a 15-year-old device that hadn't been updated in 14.9 years. But, you know, these devices are now under constant update. Mm-hmm. So how would you propose to keep the tracings current, given both the, you know, like they have to be updated in a particular way, so it isn't like you have your commercial issue, but you still end up with the issue that the pattern of operation that the basic system is going to produce is going to change.
So I've done a few tests on that with standard computers, not with our medical device, but with a Windows box that I have in the lab. Mm-hmm. And the updates I installed did not make a difference in my small sample size, which I'm not claiming will necessarily generalize. Yeah. But if it's an update that's doing something like, you know, plugging a hole in an exploit or something like that, I think that in many cases it's not going to alter the power consumption such that it'll fall afoul of our system.
Well, but so just to follow on, sure. When you do an update of your system, by and large, you're not bringing, for example, a new feature out like embedded antivirals, which
exactly. So yeah. That would certainly be yeah. a different case. Or if you were to completely like reorganize the GUI in something, then we mm-hmm. might find that it's quite a bit different. But I haven't been able to do extensive testing on those sorts of updates.
Yeah, because particular device that you looked at actually has had a series of those, which would probably change dramatically what you'd see in tracings. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.